Welcome, everyone, to our February series. We are delighted to welcome back Professor Elaine France from Kent State University. She's going to talk about the Pittsburgh Railroad strike of 1877 and the role of churches. So, all of you lovers of Pittsburgh, this is a topic just for you. And now, let's all welcome Elaine.
I'm a very excited in Seattle,
Okay, we're going to do that. Okay, it's been a little while since I've been out here, and it feels good to be back. Let's see, and I'm going to move this forward. Here we go. Okay, perfect. Oh, this way. Okay, we are ready. So, welcome. So this is going to be four lectures, and I'm making them just for you guys, but it's based on some work that I've been doing. I've been working on the 1877 strikes. And I'm just curious, how much do people know about the great strikes of 1877? Okay. Biggest labor movement in U.S. history in the 19th century, by far, largely centered in Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh is one of the centers. So Chicago, St. Louis, Pittsburgh, and a lot of other places too, probably hundreds of other places, right? But Pittsburgh is like a really important center of it. And it's going to end up with, we're going to talk about this next week when we actually talk about the strike, we do background of it today. But as a result of the strike in Pittsburgh, basically the government of Pittsburgh and of the county, the police, the sheriff, the mayor refused to suppress the strike. And they have to call in, or they feel the owners do call in the Philadelphia militia. And the Philadelphia militia ends up coming and suppressing the strike in Pittsburgh, killing 24 people right in downtown Pittsburgh who are gathered to strike. And so this is what all this is ultimately leading to. I'm working on, because we're coming up to the 150th anniversary of the strike, events. And so I've been working on the strike. I have a special issue of a journal that I'm working on, a history journal that I'm working on about the strike. And so that's why I want to talk about it now as we move towards this 150th anniversary. So first I wanted to thank Sarah and Ted for all of your work on this. You guys, they do so much work behind the scenes, so many emails, so much preparation. So you guys are really lucky to have them. And so today, though, we're not going to talk yet about the strike itself. We're going to be talking about the background to the strike. So basically, two things are going to happen in 1877, which are really important, right? And one of them is this great labor strike of 1877 that I've just been mentioning. And what's the other one? Do you guys probably already know? What's the other huge thing that happens in 1877? I'm such an undergraduate teacher. I'm sorry. I said, you. It's the end of Reconstruction, right? So 1877, two things happen. We end Reconstruction. We pull troops out of the South and stop protecting the freed people, right? And then we also suppress the strike of 1877 using federal troops, right? So I want to talk about how we get there in 1877. And specifically, I want to talk about the role of the churches in all of this. And I'm going to give you one more piece of background of how I came to it. Last summer, I gave a talk. I was invited to give a talk at Martha's Vineyard, which was very lovely, right? Which is an old Methodist campground. And they're trying to remember their religious heritage. And they wanted me to give a talk about Martha's Vineyard and its relationship to the events of 1877, and particularly that camp meeting association and its relationship to those events. So I've been thinking a lot about the relationship of churches and religious people, and particularly this is really going to exclude Catholics for reasons that may become clear as we're going through, but this is largely going to be Protestants, right? And it's largely going to be evangelical Protestants, and their role in some of the events that are happening in related to labor. Okay, so that's the basic thrust of what we're going to be talking about today. And I want to start by, we're going to talk. So first, the reformist impulse of the Second Great Awakening. How is it that churches, and particularly Protestant churches, became really involved in social movements, right? And particularly anti-slavery, but a bunch of other social movements as well. So we'll talk first of all about that, definitely including the Presbyterians. Second, we'll talk about the war and emancipation and how that changed and sort of nationalized some of these movements, made people think about social problems as not local but national, and how that they would have national solutions, had national causes and national solutions. And then we'll talk about the backlash to some of these reformist impulses in 1877, right? The backlash where we kind of stop doing some of the things we have been doing. And rising class tensions in the 1870s, and how some of this starts kind of peeling back. Okay. And you're going to notice, apparently, our aspect ratio is a little bit off. So everybody's going to look really like everybody's head's going to be really tall. I have to say, Charles Grandison Finney up there is a really strange looking man, but he looks even stranger with his head stretched out like that. So apologies. Okay. So I want to start with Charles Grandison Finney. You guys probably are already pretty familiar with him as Presbyterians. Am I right? No. Okay. He was probably the most important, the most okay, he's one of, let's say, one of the two or three most famous ministers of the 19th century. Okay, he was a Presbyterian, and he was, if you want to name a person who started what we call the Second Great Awakening, that is the big religious revival of the first half of the 19th century, that person would probably be Charles Grandison Finney. So Charles Grandison Finney had been a lawyer and kind of a businessman, but kind of a business-facing lawyer and a prosperous man. He had a religious conversion in 1821. He goes out to the woods. He falls on his knees. He's converted to spend his life. You know, he feels like he's been born again, right? He's been sanctified, and he is going to spend the rest of his life. He says, from now on, I'm going to be a lawyer for Jesus Christ. Okay. And he becomes one of the most powerful preachers of the antebellum period, the period before the Civil War. And he's going to do a lot of revivals. He's going to travel all over the country doing a lot of revivals. But he's mainly going to be focused in New York City, where he's going to have a pastorate at a Presbyterian church in New York City. what Charles Grandison Finney represents, and I'll just use him to summarize the Second Great Awakening, but basically what he represents, some new ideas in Christianity that he represents, is he's moving mainstream Protestant thought from one that is focused in ideas of predestination, right? Calvinist ideas of predestination, which have been being atrophied over the years, right? But he's kind of saying, no, you can choose salvation, right? And you can choose salvation largely through the means of attending revivals and having a conversion experience. Okay. So he brings in revival as a technique. He calls it his new measures. And he would do really crazy things. Like he would have what he called an anxious bench up at the front of the church. and people who were feeling like maybe they were ready to convert, or people whose family members felt like maybe they're ready to convert, right? Could like drag them up, you know, put them on the anxious bench. And then Charles Grandison Finney, who apparently was a very, very powerful preacher, would preach right at them, right? So he was getting a lot of people who were having intense religious experiences at the service, at these revivals. They'd fall to the ground, right? They'd feel the sanctification that he had felt in the woods. And so he's doing this. He becomes very famous doing this together with his new measures and his new technique and his new idea of salvation. He also starts a focus. He doesn't start this, but he's part of a larger trend to start to focus on kind of saving the world. Okay. So he starts to say, look, if you really are a Christian, one thing you're going to do is get involved in improving things, right? Kind of like making the world better. Okay. He says social reform is a necessary element of redemption, right? Humanity will be able to reform itself. So these are the beginnings of a move towards post-millennialism, or sort of an idea that we, through our own efforts, are going to make the world ultimately perfect. Okay. And he also focuses on things like the emotional side of religion over the intellectual side. So he says, well, it's not necessarily crucial that every minister have a really fancy education. You could be an illiterate minister, right? You could be a poor person who's never had any education, but if your heart is in the right place and if you love Jesus, right, you can be a minister, right? And so you have the rise of this idea that you should focus on the sort of passion and faith of people over their intellectual knowledge of, you know, details of theology. Finney does publish a theology of his own, but his theology, he kind of is just like, look, this is just common sense. You should be able to get to theology just by being a decent person, being a moral person. You shouldn't have to think through all the details. You shouldn't have to think through all like, oh, you know, what is baptism or like, what is transubstantiation? He's kind of like that. It shouldn't matter too much. What should really matter is that you not be selfish, right? And he actually talks about it. He says, sin is simply selfishness, right? So he's trying to make things sort of common sense. And he's trying to say, if you became a Christian, what you would mainly do is go help people, right? And go be benevolent, right? And I'm summarizing it as though he's doing all of this, but there's a whole movement of people out there doing all of this, and he's the most famous of them, the most influential of them. So other people, I have a quote here from a Methodist camp leader, actually Martha's Vineyard camp leader. He says from 1852, he says, the cause of Christ universally is onward. Progress is a law of universal nature. Both vegetable and animal rise from almost unobservable incipiency to the strength of maturity by this law, the law of progress. The human intellect also by the same law grows and strengthens indefinitely. So also is the progress of moral man. And so they believe that they're in that, that we are sort of progressing to a more moral world, right? In the same way that Darwin, and right, this is the age of Darwin, right? In the same way that, that Darwin is talking about this progression. Okay. And because of this emphasis on the sort of passion of religion rather than on formal education, this opens up the door not only to poor white male ministers who become really prominent, particularly within Methodism and in the Baptist church, right? But not only them, but it also opens up the door to people of color, enslaved ministers even, you know, become fairly common in the South, but free people of color in the North. Okay, this is a famous woman named Zilpha Elah, who becomes not a minister. She never gets her own church, but she becomes a religious exhorter. She will go to camp meetings, which are happening everywhere, including in Castle Shannon, right? She will go to camp meetings and she will, talk about her, her passion for Christ and urge people to become Christians. She will knock on people's doors in cities, wealthy people, and she'll say, "Jesus Christ has sent me to save you." And they will let her in. And she will convert people at their wealthy homes, right? So it's this kind of crazy enthusiasm, right, that's kind of spreading. And it's open to the agency of people that aren't very otherwise very powerful. Okay. And here is just an image of just a whole bunch of ministers at one camp meeting. This is again a Martha's Vineyard because I just gave a lecture about that. But this is an image of these, a whole bunch of ministers who gathered for a week at Martha's Vineyard, and people would just preach all day long. They'd rise together. They'd do family prayer together. And then they'd go to sermons basically like all day until the night. They take a couple little breaks where they could walk around. And then they'd pray together at night. And then, as each family would finish their family prayer in their own tent, they'd yell, "Hallelujah," like, we've victory over Satan or whatever, but it was a very, very enthusiastic time. Okay. But there's also a more respectable angle to this. People who were fairly prosperous, people who were fairly wealthy. Finney himself, where it was coming from a pretty prosperous background, were really often drawn to this. It was a lot of business people, particularly, really were drawn to the Second Great Awakening faith. And this guy here, Henry Ward Beecher. I said that Charles Grandison Finney was one of the most famous ministers of the 19th century. And here's another of them, right? From the famous Beecher family of reformists and ministers, Henry Ward Beecher, he's the wealthier end of this, right? And he agreed with a lot of what people were saying. He agreed with, the importance of, the most humble being lifted up, right? But at the same time, he also emphasized the fact that this is completely consistent with capitalism, right? And with differences in classes, because if you became a good Christian, and if you were, once you were converted, what you would do is you'd be honest, you'd be, good to other people, and you would work hard, you'd be diligent, and you would rise through the system, right? And so he actually felt very, and he emphasized that being prosperous, people actually called this a gospel of wealth, right? That being prosperous was actually a sign of your religious achievement, right? That if you were, that one reason that you should be a Christian, right? And a good Christian is that it would help you to succeed. And so he didn't see, and he represented another really important part of the Second Great Awakening, which is there should be no tension between the rich and poor, because the poor, once they are good Christians, will simply become the rich, right? That this is a land of opportunity. It does sound like Joel Osteen, right? No, that's exactly right. Or Horatio Alger, right, from the time, right? But no, that's exactly right. Okay. I will also mention one other thing just for you to kind of put a marker on. One thing that Charles Grandison Finney is really worried about is that too many of the people who were being converted by him, a disproportionate number, were women, right? And he was constantly saying, "Where are the men? Where are the men?" He's getting men. He's getting some men. It's a huge movement, right? But he's like, disproportionately, it's the women who are doing this, and we need to really focus on the missing men. So he'd do things like have businessmen's revivals in the city over lunch, So that now men who are coming into the city now to work, right, are able to like go to these revivals together, kind of just for men. So he's really also interested in kind of the problem of men in Christianity. Okay. So this the Second Great Awakening is going to spawn, not too surprisingly, a whole bunch of social movements. And we can just, I'll just list some of the ones that were big at the time. But a lot of people who became involved in the Second Great Awakening became involved in a whole bunch of these social movements, like missionary work. And that would be probably to the indigenous people, right, to the West, or sometimes now to China, right, where we're doing a lot of trade with China at this point, right, or to poor people. Okay, charity work, similarly, right, the temperance movement is getting really big, even in the antebellum period. Social purity, that's anti-prostitution movement. Prison reform becomes important in this period, and they're trying to build better prisons to really save people and get them back into society, right? The vegetarianism movement becomes really big. And if you like graham crackers, right, graham crackers, Sylvester Graham comes out of this movement. Though there weren't any honey, there wasn't any honey or cinnamon in these graham crackers, right? This was just the cracker. Yeah. So anti-cruelty, anti-cruelty to animals, you get the SP, the movements against cruelty to animals and to children, right, coming out of this period. So they get involved in a whole bunch of these movements. They have separate organizational entities. They form into voluntary associations, but it's really coming out of the churches. The people involved in are the same people as the people who are the Second Great Awakening church members. But especially abolitionism. So increasingly by the 1840s and 1850s, members of these churches are very skeptical about slavery, okay? And they feel like slavery, at the very least, needs to be reformed, right? And increasingly, they're starting to say, well, it probably needs to be ended altogether. There's probably something, fundamentally wrong about keeping people in bondage. And so people who are involved in these movements tend to move towards abolitionism earlier than other people, and particularly in the 1840s and 1850s. In the South, the Second Great Awakening had actually attracted a lot of people who were enslaved, right? And obviously they're going to oppose slavery, to some extent. It had also attracted a lot of slave owners. And some people early in the movement in the South, early in the Second Great Awakening, actually do give up their slaves, form things like anti-colonization or colonization societies to like let go of their slaves and, send them off to Africa, right? So you do have some of that coming out of the Second Great Awakening. But by the 1830s in the South, abolitionism has really been stigmatized because there had been the Nat Turner Rebellion in the South had made it dangerous for abolitionists. The backlash to some of the slave rebellion had made it dangerous to be an abolitionist in the South. And so in the South, the Second Great Awakening Church had sort of accommodated itself to slavery and not been as loud, and even in some cases started to defend slavery in the Southern Church. In the Northern Church, there's a question about what to do with slavery as it becomes a more and more political issue, and as the South pushes back against anti-slavery positions. And so you get a fracture in the North between those people in Second Great Awakening churches who want to say we should end slavery, and those people who want to say, well, maybe we can just reform it, or maybe there's nothing wrong with it, right? A lot of Northern churches fracture in the 1840s and 1850s. And the Presbyterian Church actually spawns a Free Presbyterian Synod in 1847, which starts in Cincinnati. So you basically get a split between pro-slavery or slavery tolerant and anti-slavery Christians. However, I want to emphasize that class issues aren't really part of this, right? That because of this sort of, you know, Beecherite idea of social climbing in the United States and the lack of class conflict, there isn't a real effort in the Second Great Awakening reform movements to do anything about like workers, you know, as a class. Like, we're going to do workers' rights, or we're interested in like, you know, workers' safety or whatever. Nobody's doing anything like that at this point. Okay, the Civil War is going to change a lot of things. And one thing that it's going to do is it's going to, it's several things that it's going to do. It's going to make us all think of our identity in a national way. Increasingly, instead of thinking of ourselves, oh, I'm from Pennsylvania, I'm from Pittsburgh, we're going to think, oh, I'm from the United States, right? We're going to do it because our family members have fought in this war. We've invested a lot in this war. We're reading a lot more national news now. There's a lot more circulation of information, right? And so in a whole bunch of different ways, we start thinking of ourselves as national citizens at the time of the Civil War. So it makes us think more of our identity as national. It also makes us more capable of organizing our ideas nationally. The Civil War drastically increases the speed and effectiveness of transportation and communication, right? Because we set up things for military purposes, which then can be used for social purposes, right? So we become much more networked, much more interconnected because of the technologies introduced by the Civil War. And then it also concentrates capital. Okay, so the other thing is it's going to do is it's going to lead to the rise for the first time of really big, nationally significant companies, right? A lot of these are railroad companies, right? But also steel is starting to emerge, you know, because it's starting to concentrate and things like that, right? So it's going to concentrate capital, but it's also going to promote a Christian nationalism, right? An idea that, which has always been present in the United States from its start, but an idea that God's plan for us has to do with America's future, with our national future, and that not only should we try to improve our communities as Christians, we should also try to do something for America. Okay. And we have here Julia Ward Howe with kind of her famous, this is the best example of this, but her, you know, battle hymn of the Republic, you know, in the Civil War, where she kind of mobilizes Christian language and Christian ideas for the cause of the war. A lot of people are doing that, both in the North and the South, actually, right? But you have a real increase in Christian nationalism during this time. But also it gives people who were trying to reform things, and particularly people who were who were abolitionist, it gives them an idea that they can be effective, that we actually can create a godly commonwealth, that when we fight for things, perhaps we can win, and now maybe we can solve some of the problems beyond slavery. Okay, so this is going to spawn a flurry of reforms. And these reforms after the war are largely going to be, again, at the center of them is going to be Protestant evangelical Christians, right? Still inspired by many of the same things and now kind of supercharged by their sense of victory in this war. Okay, so we've talked before in other lectures, we've talked about the temperance movement, you know, women's rights really comes rushing in at this moment. We won't really talk about that. But it also, it fosters a lot of efforts to improve the lives of freed people who've just been liberated. The American Missionary Association raises $6 million, which actually is, you know, even now, that feels like a lot of money to me, right? But it raises $6 million to try to improve the lives of freed people in the South. So people are just emptying their pockets in Northern churches And the AMA is largely operated through the churches. So you're going to go to a church meeting on Wednesdays, an AMA meeting in your church. You're going to empty your pockets and send money down to help the freed people. The Presbyterians set up their own organization, which works side by side with the AMA. Some Presbyterians work inside the AMA, but they also set up the Presbyterian Board of Missions. And the Presbyterian Boards of Missions, Presbyterian Board of Missions for Freedmen. The Presbyterian Board of Missions for Freedmen donates over $1 million just on its own. Okay, Presbyterians are extremely active in this. Together, the AMA and the Presbyterians, they found 11 HBCUs, historically black college. They weren't historical then, right? But they found like 11 black colleges and universities. They found a whole bunch of normal schools, and actually the Presbyterians are particularly interested in normal schools, which just train teachers. They're not quite colleges, but they train teachers to teach in the South. They also send down, the AMA and the Presbyterians together send down over 500 teachers for Freedmen School. So all sorts of people are volunteering to go down and teach. So they're doing all these things. At the same time, problems are beginning to emerge back at home, back in the North, where labor and workers are beginning to complain about their conditions. Okay, so everything seems to be going great. It feels like maybe we're just going to almost achieve a millennium, and people talk about it like that. Maybe we'll achieve a sort of perfection in society through all of these Christians working together. But okay. Sorry, I didn't mean to bring them. But yes.
Remind us what the year was when this was happening.
Okay. This is the 1860s and 70s. So the period I'm talking about right now is 1865, right, up to 1876, right? A period of huge amount of investment by churches and these associated groups in social movements of all sorts, but really highlighting the freed people. Okay, doing a huge amount to try to help out with the freed people. I mean, it was a massive effort.
And is it right that that didn't go down well in the South?
No, well,
like the freedmen's schools, how popular were they in the South?
So the Klan is attacking the freedmen schools, right? You know, the freedmen schools, you know, there's problems because Southern whites aren't particularly happy with efforts to politically empower freed people, right? And then also there's a military occupation, right? So there's soldiers down there for most of this period who really, there's not that many, but there are in some places soldiers down there who are enforcing this, and Southern whites don't like it. So this is also the period of like Southern white pushback and the Klan and whatnot. But at the same time, the religious associations are keeping on sending down these kind of white missionaries, but missionaries themselves will get attacked by the Klan. You know, these kind of female missionaries will be routed out by the Klan and things like that. So there's a huge amount of pushback, but there's a lot of, you know, persistence and a real sense of righteousness on the part of Northern, you know, religious folks, right? So it was a really big deal. Okay, however, at the same time, there's problems back at home, right? Up in the North, you have problems where, okay, well, actually, what the next thing I was going to say about problems is the occupation of the South is hitting some snags. Okay, so as Ted pointed out, there's a lot of pushback from the white people in the South. But then at the same time, it's super expensive to occupy the South, right? People are getting tired of spending all this money to support the soldiers, spending all this money, you know, for the freed people. Collections are starting to dry up a little bit. Okay. But the other problem is that there is a massive capitalist transformation in the North, okay, with folks like Carnegie around here. But basically, You have the consolidation of capital, you have the rise of really big companies, and this has happened and really been supercharged by the war. And people are starting increasingly to work, you know, to urbanize. There's a massive urbanization. People are moving to the cities, but they're also working for larger and larger companies where they feel like they don't have as much autonomy. They don't have as much say. And this is causing some tension and some labor unrest. Okay. And particularly for returning veterans who have a sense of their own significance and their own investment in the country, right? And other people who felt like they've invested in, you know, the victory of the North and in the making of the nation. They're like, well, we should be treated well. Like, we don't want to feel like we're being, you know, kicked around. You know, we should be being paid more. And, you know, we shouldn't have these increasingly restrictive work rules, you know, placed on us by capitalists who, to their credit, if they're going to run such big companies, they need to have more restrictive rules, right? Just to keep order, right? So you have capital, you have really wealthy, big companies now, which are trying to keep order, and they're having to be more, they are being more restrictive on workers, and they're also, workers feel like it's less likely they're going to make it up the chain with these kind of more centralized capitalist systems. They'll never become Andrew Carnegie, right? So you get a lot of class resentment emerging, and you get the upsurge of unionization nationally, particularly between 1869 and 1874. You have the rise of unions. And there were some unions before, right? Even before Civil War, a couple of unions. But you have the rise of unionization, particularly where some of these kind of newly empowered workers are saying, we demand, you know, more power, right, within this economic system. Okay. Churches don't tend to jump in right away in support of these workers' movements. Even the evangelical churches who are really invested in helping out Southern Black workers, right, don't see that the same conditions are relevant, right, because there's a different history, right, with Northern workers who are also now making demands. And in fact, I want to be fair here and not, but in some ways, a lot of the evangelical Protestant churches are very, very prosperous. They have become, in many ways, like with Beecher, the sort of churches of the wealthy. And this is just a chart. This is a later chart from the, I couldn't find a chart like this because I think people weren't as organized to make a, you know, written chart from the period I'm talking about. But at the time, you would pay pew rent, you know, and depending on how much you paid, that would be where you could sit in the church, right? And then there were some places in the back for like really poor people, you know, who just like sit wherever. But the good pews, you would pay an annual pew rent. And those pew rents could be really high, right? Like $500 a year, you know, at that, you know, in the dollars of this time to sit in Henry Ward Beecher's church, you know, up at the front in New York City, right? So really, really, so the churches in some ways had become invested in prosperity, right? In some ways, right? And so we're a little bit more skeptical about some of these labor movements themselves. And I'm going to have to kind of, I'll speed up through the rest, but this is the moment when you get the rise of Karl Marx, right? Marx comes out in the 1850s and he's starting to spread over, you know, through Europe and even to the United States. The ideas of Karl Marx are, you know, in the newspapers and things like that by the time of the Civil War. And 1871 in France, and we don't know about this and we don't worry about it or think about it too much, but I will say that people in the United States freaked out about the Paris Commune. Okay, the Paris Commune was a socialist revolution in France, right, that briefly took over Paris. It was very violent. It was a really big deal. And it took over the front pages of the newspapers. The workers took over Paris, drove out the capitalists, killed a lot of people, right? And then a lot more of them were killed, right? It was a very bloody, very big deal. And it scared the heck out of, you know, people in the United States who thought, well, maybe this is going to come here, especially we're getting all these European immigrants, like, you know, coming with these ideas. Okay. So there's a lot of anxiety about this. And at the same time, you have the rise of louder, you do have the rise of louder workers' voices, right? And you have the rise of socialism in the United States at this moment. And this guy, Andrew Cameron, is a big, he has a newspaper in Chicago. He's kind of a famous socialist worker advocate. He has a paper that's called, I think it's called The Workers' Advocate. And he's using the language of Second Great Awakening Christianity to push for socialism and workers' rights, right? And so he says, one quote, but his paper is all full of religious language, but he says, to criticize church support of capitalism. He says, it is this superlative cant and truckling to mammon which has brought the modern church into disrepute and caused the working classes to look upon its teachings with suspicion and distrust. Okay. And they do bring some ministers, do begin to side with workers and even socialist worker organizations in cities like Chicago, right? And start to use some of their resources to, so they serve as lecturers, organizers, or even join workers' associations or even participate in strikes and things like that. So you do have some ministers who are becoming sort of like pro-labor ministers. Okay, in 1876, you have you guys heard of this guy? Okay, I love this man. Washington Gladden in 1876, he's Reverend Washington Gladden. He publishes in 1876 a book called The Working People and Their Employers. And this is often seen as the beginning of what's going to emerge as the social gospel, okay? It's going to emerge as the social gospel. And so he writes this book, and basically he says, both sides in the labor conflict need to place the spirit of Christian love ahead of self-interest. They need to, quote, impart a spirit that thinks less of personal power or gain or glory than of the common good. Where this spirit abounds, there is always unity and fruitfulness. Where this spirit is not, there is confusion and all kinds of evil. Okay, he's speaking to workers and he's saying, pipe down, right? But he's also speaking to owners and he's saying, you have to do better, right? And this is going to be the way that Christians in this evangelical trajectory are going to deal with this workers' movement. They're going to try to be sort of mediators, you know, between the two sides in this exploding situation. So this book comes out in 1876, and in 1877 is when we're going to have the great big Pittsburgh labor strike. So next week, what I want to talk about is what we do, and I'll focus in next week on Pittsburgh. But I want to say next week, I want to talk about what we do in Pittsburgh, and particularly what churches do and what ministers do when the strike does come in 1876. So thank you. Do we have time for questions?
Okay. Yes. So I have, I'm struck by some of the parallels of this time period that you're talking about and our present situation where there is great concern about, where there was a great concern about social justice that you're describing the rise of, And at the same time, some rising resentments about that movement, self-righteous proclamation of self of social justice.
So the question is?
The question is that I need to think of a question.
Do I see parallels? Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I definitely, you know, definitely I see parallels, right? And, you know, and I think part of what you're identifying too is a kind of pendulum where workers are demanding more, right? There's this era of like, wow, we can really solve things. Like there's been this huge issue, slavery, and now it's just like done, taken care of. Now we're on to the next thing. We can just do it. And I think there's times we felt like, you know, at least social justice warriors, right, have felt like, wow, we're really moving forward, really taking care of a lot of social problems. It's really an era of progress, you know, and then that causes, you know, it's that backlash, you know.
So maybe here's the question. It seems like social justice was a cause of the evangelicals in this period.
Yes.
And we're perhaps presently living in a time where social justice is less of a cause of evangelical churches. Is that a valid thought? Did that same thing happen after 1877?
So I think there's plenty of evangelical churches who are involved in social justice now. You know, I mean, it depends on what you mean by evangelical. Like I'm using the term evangelical, which now refers to a particular social movement within Christianity, right? Evangelica at the time, that would be the churches who are like mainstream. Yeah. Yeah. So, but it is true that the churches were absolutely the backbone of any reform movement of this time. And you know, to the extent that they're not now, right, that they really aren't today. And the question is like, you know, and part of what happened is that church going decreased, right? Part of what happened is that other forms of communication and other forms of community maybe displaced the centrality of the church and the sermon, right, and these organizations. Yeah.
But I have read that that many young men are now joining evangelical churches.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, the population is not the right word, but the membership, I guess, in those churches has increased significantly.
Yeah, I think I've heard that too.
So how do we separate social justice from politics?
Yeah, and people were even saying that, like at the time, it's like, okay, these are good things to do, but you shouldn't do it through the mechanism and through the institutions of the church, right? So that was definitely an issue. And actually what's gonna happen, if you're familiar with fundamentalism, right? Fundamentalism is gonna emerge as a sort of backlash to social justice. What fundamentalism is going to emerge right in, like, let's say 1910s. And what they're going to say is churches need to get back to the fundamentals, right? We need to get out of, it's not about, oh, you know, do we want to give people bread or a Bible, right? The fundamentalists are saying, well, it's most important that we give them a Bible, right? You know, and too many Christians have focused on the bread first and they're forgetting like why we're here. So you're going to get like a rise of this kind of backlash because social justice or the social gospel movement is going to get really huge over the, you know, the period after 1877. But then it's going to spawn its backlash. They're like, what if we actually like look at the details of the Bible? Like, what if we absolutely center the teachings of Christ and get away from social and political things? So, yeah.
I think you specifically focus on Protestantism. Where are the Catholics at this point?
Oh, see? Ah, okay. Catholics are complicated because Catholics are, first of all, Catholic priests don't have the kind of relationship to their flocks as Protestants do, Protestant ministers do, and Catholics don't have the kind of voluntary association adjunct going on with them, right? So, but then also, like, Catholic priests at this time are preaching in Latin, and they're preaching with their back to the congregation, right? You know, this is way pre-Vatican II, right? So the Catholics really are, but then at the same time, the Catholics really are a lot of these workers who are rising up, right? Especially around here, are in fact Catholics. A lot of people in the strikes of 1877 are going to be Catholics. So these ministers are having to, the Catholic priests are having to, you know, hold funerals for deceased workers, you know, and things like that. So they are pulled into it, but because of the structure of the church, they're not as active. You are going to have, in the 1890s, you're going to have the Pope actually say, you know, come out with an encyclical that says, kind of, we have to focus on social justice issues. You know, you actually have the Pope, and I think I want to say it's 1894, that comes out with an encyclical. He's just like, we have to not just think about theology, not just think about what's happening in the church, but we have to get there and intervene in society. And in particular, he talks about the evils of capitalism. But he also talks about the evils of labor unions, right? So he gets right in there, you know, in that same space that a lot of the Protestants are getting to, where they're like, let's see if we can find a middle ground, right? And so the Catholics are playing with this, but the Catholic leadership isn't as significant in this just because of how they're structured. Similarly, there's a Jewish, you know, particularly around here, there's a Jewish equivalent, kind of a Jewish social gospel. This is when you're going to start getting Reform Judaism. Right in this period, they're going to do a lot of the same things.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.